Mint Records and CITR and Discorder present Edmonton's indie psych favorite, Faith Healer. It's their first time in Vancouver, so let's show some Van City love on Saturday, March 3rd at the Astoria, with special guests Local Fuzz Poppers Supermoon and Ellen Noon from Victoria.
Good evening, Vancouver. You're listening to UBC Happy Hour on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from unceded Musqueam and Coast Salish territory. I'm Alex Lenz, and I'm the UBC Affairs Collective Coordinator. So this show is produced by the UBC Affairs Collective. So if you like what you hear and you want to contribute to help make the show, you can send me an email at ubcaffairs@citr.ca. So happy reading break, everyone. I hope everyone is having a relaxing week. This week we're going to be talking to Max Holmes, who is the VP Academic at the Alma Mater Society here at UBC, about a campaign called Textbook Broke, which is aiming to make textbooks more affordable for students. This is kind of an appropriate time to be talking about textbooks because you guys should be reading. If you're not reading, that's also okay. So this is my interview with Max Holmes from the AMS. Okay, so this is Alex Lenz with UBC Happy Hour, and I am joined by... Sorry, for some reason I can't hear out of these headphones. Whatever, it's recording, so I don't need them. Okay, I'm going to restart. Hello, listeners. This is Alex Lenz with the UBC Happy Hour on CITR 101.9 FM, and I am joined in studio by Max Holmes, who is the VP Academic at the AMS. Hello, Max.
Hi. Thanks for having me, Alex.
Thank you. So, Max, could you just start off by introducing yourself and what role you do at the AMS?
So I'm the AMS VP Academic and University Affairs. So it's my job to advocate for all 54,000 plus students at UBC to the university administration, as well as to the Board of Governors, to Senate, and all levels of the university. I'm also a student senator at large, and so I sit on the Senate Curriculum Committee, the Agenda Committee. So my area of expertise is really advocacy and advanced education, and really just making sure that all the issues that are important to students are issues that are important and tackled by the university.
That sounds like a lot of responsibility. Wow. Is that a lot of work? That sounds like a lot of work.
It's quite a bit of work. You know, we have a large team that, you know, is very helpful, so that is great for all of us. I sit on Student Senate Caucus, so we've got tons of senators from every single faculty and four other student senators at large, as well as our two Board of Governors student representatives who I work with for anything with the Board of Governors. So I have a lot of help.
Yeah, awesome. And what do you study?
So I am currently an art student, no declared major yet,
Right. Second
year right now, but hopefully we'll get something declared soon.
Nice. Okay. Yeah. There's always that stress in second year of like, what is my major going to be? But, I'm sure you'll figure it out. Cool. So yeah, we're talking about Textbook Broke, which is a campaign that's being run by the AMS. So what is Textbook Broke?
So Textbook Broke was really a campaign that came to fruition when we were looking at the really high cost of educational resources, which have been high cost for a while. And Textbook Broke is an educational campaign for students, for faculty, for anyone who really wants to know about higher education resources. And it talks about the current expenses for students for textbooks, which goes above $800 plus per year for undergraduate students. And it talks about alternatives that we could be using, like open educational resources, which are free and easy to use.
Yeah. So according to the Student Government Resource Center, 65% of student consumers have opted out of buying a textbook for a class because the price was too high. And further to that, 94% of those students have suffered academically as a result. So, yeah, I know that I have opted out of buying textbooks in the past because I think that they cost too much and I'm not necessarily going to get, yeah, it's like a cost-benefit analysis, like how much of a benefit am I going to get from having this textbook versus the cost I'm going to have to pay for it. So yeah, how is this campaign kind of striving to help students succeed in their academic life?
Well, those numbers really aren't surprising to us because in our own academic experience survey that we do every year, we found those numbers and we've even found numbers that are even higher than that. And so it's no surprise that students, don't decide to buy a textbook because these textbooks are expensive. And often there are professors that don't even use these textbooks. And so what we're hoping to do with the Textbook Broke campaign is really to come out, to really push to have open educational resource adoption. Because through this adoption, not only do we help students at UBC, but we help people across the province that can't afford to come to UBC, who can't afford to learn at UBC. And these are resources that would be available to everyone. So this doesn't just benefit us and students and faculty, but it also benefits the entire province and anyone throughout the world who would want to use these resources.
That's really interesting. So what is an open educational resource?
Yeah, so basically an open educational resource is something that people come together to really put together something like a textbook almost, except it's online, it's easily accessible, and it's something that's edited often by multiple people. They are very new in some fields. There are some fields that have been doing this for a while now. One of the projects that we actually did was a heat map looking at both arts and science and open educational resources being used in those faculties. And we found that arts actually has the faculties that have the costliest textbooks and the costliest departments to be in as a student, while science has actually some of the cheapest departments to be in as a student. And so that's really shown that in science, for example, math, they've really pushed forward to try and have open resource adoption. And so it's really something that is supposed to be used as a textbook almost, supposed to be used as a learning resource, but it can be used any way. You can print it out from online, you can have it on an iPad, you can have it on your phone. You can really use it in whichever way that you want, and it's something that multiple people can contribute to. You know, the one thing about textbooks is it's very limiting who contributes to those resources, and they're very difficult to change. Mm-hmm. Open educational resources, if a professor realizes, you know, that's actually not right, that needs to be changed, they could change that whenever they want. Mm-hmm. It's not something that's very difficult to do. So it's something that's very adaptable. And in today's environment, having adaptable educational resources is so important.
That's really fascinating to me because, A, I think that touches upon kind of this idea of, you know, the democratization of education. Mm-hmm. But also, you know, I think one kind of complaint that I've heard from my peers in some of my classes is, oh, this textbook, like, this is from the 80s. Like, why is this still, why are we learning this now? Which, of course, you know, there might be a reason why your professor has chosen an article from, you know, an earlier time period. Maybe it's still relevant or, you know, we're kind of learning the relevance of that or something, you know. But yeah, I think that this is so fascinating because, yeah, textbooks are, I feel like they often kind of seem like this really outdated concept. And so this is like a really fresh idea.
You know?
Yeah.
Textbooks are an outdated concept. They're something that we've had for a while. And the interesting thing is I've had conversations with professors that when they were at UBC, this was the same issue that they had, except there wasn't a solution when they were a student, and there wasn't necessarily the same housing crisis that there is now. You know, also the tuition crisis that we're also having with rising tuition every single year. And so textbooks is actually the one area where we can actually tackle affordability, where we can say students spend $814 and up, you know, per year on textbooks. Is that reasonable? Shouldn't the university be using, you know, students' money to really push forward? And if we're going to be having all these different funds that are for strategic initiatives, you know, one of the most important initiatives that we could have is creating open educational resources. And I think a lot of people are in favor of that.
Yeah. So I want to kind of go back to what you were saying about how open educational resources are can be used kind of outside the student body. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, could you maybe talk about that a little bit more?
Yeah, so open educational resources, we would hope that if UBC did create these resources, that they'd be online and they'd be available to anyone. You wouldn't have to come to UBC to use an open educational resource in math, for example, or economics, or any other discipline. And so what that would do is it would allow for us not only to collaborate with other universities to create open educational resources and to have people contribute to those open educational resources, but it would allow people who can't afford to go to university. You know, if you have a full-time job and, you know, you're no longer, you know, 20-something and you want to learn more about business, for example, because you're running a small business, this is something that could be used by you. This isn't something that just benefits students, but it benefits all people that want to be learners. And it really goes for that example of lifelong learning, that, you know, when you leave university, you should be able to look back at what you learned. You should be able to enhance that learning. And open educational resources really opens that up for everyone.
Mm. Wow, cool. So you were talking about these surveys that the AMS kind of conducted on students. So yeah, how did you guys kind of collect all of this data about student spending?
Yeah, so the Academic Experience Survey is something that we run once annually. It's actually open right now if anyone wants to go take it.
Nice, okay.
And there's lots of prizes that you can win, up to $250. But
to go to my textbook? Yeah.
Exactly. And so what's amazing about this survey is that we usually get high participation every single year. It has around a 2% margin of error. And we ask so many different questions. We ask, you know, have you ever used an open educational resource is a question that we added this year to see who has used these and have they been helpful. We also ask, have you ever gotten textbook resources through maybe not so legal ways? You know, we ask all of these questions. And what's so surprising is the amount of people that we see that say that they have bought a textbook and never used it. The amount of people who have said that they decided not to buy a textbook because it was too expensive. And the amount of people who also say at the same time that a textbook or the educational resources that they're supposed to buy are essential to their learning. And one of the things that we've been seeing through these surveys is that, you know, textbook companies know what's happening. They know that people realize that, you know, the textbook game is really just not something people want to be in anymore. And so what they've done is bundling. You know, they're trying to find solutions to this, and they're trying to still make a profit off of students. And the way that they do that is through course access codes. Everyone has had, you know, My Econ Lab or something like that, where you have to buy the textbook, even though you may never use it. And the reason you have to buy it is because of that one little code that ends up costing you $80 if you buy it on its own, which is, of course, ridiculous.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I could imagine that a challenging aspect of this would be getting professors on board, because that's kind of, yeah, where I guess the, like the monkey wrench, I don't know if that's the right expression, would lie in this, this whole campaign. So yeah, has that been, how have you guys been selling this idea to professors?
Well, the AMS has actually done something really unique this year, which is an OER listening tour. And this listening tour is going out to every single faculty at UBC and talking to professors. And we've already spoken to hundreds of professors. And what we're really trying to learn is we're trying to figure out, you know, what are the barriers? You know, why don't people want to adopt OERs? And we've already found huge trends already. Obviously, the study's not finished. But what we have found is professors have said, I don't have the time or resources. No one is willing, you know, to really put money towards this. And if anything, professors are actually very willing to do this. There are a lot of professors that want to go into OER creation because not only is it beneficial for them, but it's something that can help them get to tenure. It's something that benefits their students. And it's something that they know that their educational resources will be more adaptable. No one wants to be tied down by a textbook that never changes. And I think that professors want to be a part of this, but the university really needs to be the one, you know, to put forward the money. That's what has to happen here, is that there needs to be resource allocation. And we're hopeful with the new strategic plan that the university will really come out and say that they're going to support OER creation, that they're not only going to do this for UBC students, for professors, but for the entire province.
Yeah, so I guess the OERs, so would that kind of presumably, would it kind of be like the university would take on the kind of cost of investing in these resources, and then that would kind of shoulder the burden from students having to pay for textbooks onto the university? Is that kind of like the is that how it works?
Yeah, so the university has a lot of strategic funds. So they have the Excellence Fund, which has millions of dollars in it, as well as they have the Teaching and Learning Enhancement Fund, which has $2.5 million allocated a year. I actually sit on the adjudication committee for that. And something that we already see is that people are putting forward projects to that committee to fund OERs. Mm. But there is no organized OER adoption across the university. And that's the problem, is the university needs to come out, they need to put the resources towards this, and they need to say that this is a serious issue that they want to tackle. And it's not that they don't have the money, because they do in their strategic initiatives funds as well as the TLEF. It's whether they want to do this. It's whether they want to help student affordability, whether they want to do something that will not only benefit all of UBC, but will benefit the entire province and anyone else who wants to use these resources.
Mm-hmm. So how has kind of the AMS been selling this idea to the university?
So we've really pushed very hard for this to be in the strategic plan. We were disappointed that when the strategic plan first came out that it wasn't in there. But we've been pushing since we saw the first draft that we're not going to support a strategic plan. We're not going to support a vision for the university that doesn't include OERs, that doesn't include affordability for students, because this is an important issue. Other universities are going to start doing this, and UBC can be at the forefront of this. Mm-hmm. UBC can, really be the one to push people in the right direction. UBC has time and time again shown throughout history that, we've been the ones to really be the first to do something. And I think that mass OER adoption that is funded through strategic initiatives funds, through the TLEF fund, and other resources that the university has is a great opportunity, and we're hopeful that they're going to do it.
Yeah, so how has UBC been collaborating with other universities on this initiative?
So UBC in particular, CTLT has been doing a lot of research around the, current adoption at our university and other universities. There was a recent article that they published that actually since we started adopting OERs that we have saved $5 to $7 million for students. Wow. Over that time period, which has only been a couple years. Mm-hmm. And it has affected over 15,000 students at UBC, which is amazing. And that's more data that we're hoping to collect, because we know that for advocacy for OERs, it's really data-driven. You have to push this and say, this is what shows, here's the savings, here's what shows mm-hmm. that this not only doesn't make, teaching in the course worse, but it actually makes it better often the learning mm-hmm. outcomes. And that's what's so important, is that we need to use other universities across British Columbia, Canada, and the world to really show where OERs have excelled. But of course, this is something new. This is something that hasn't been going on for a while. And UBC really needs to be the one to commit and say, we're going to be the leaders in OER creation. We're going to be the leaders in OER adoption. We're going to do something that other Canadian universities haven't done, and we are going to put forward the money for this. And we're hopeful that that can be something that when people look at UBC, that's the reason that they come here. Mm-hmm. That we have affordable resources. We're not using old, outdated textbooks. We are using, open resources that anyone can use.
Hmm. Yeah, I think that that's one thing that maybe a lot of people don't necessarily know about the AMS, is that a lot of your campaigns, you do collaborate with other mm-hmm. schools. We also did an interview with Sally Lynn about the Rent with Rights campaign.
Yeah.
And I'm really impressed and also pleased to hear that the AMS does a lot of collaboration with other student governments, because it's just, ideas flowing, and obviously, there's so much more power in, kind of collective action than mm-hmm. if it's just our one school.
Well, and that's one of the greatest things about this, is that this is all about putting resources out there that anyone can use. So all of the resources that we use for the Textbook Broke campaign, we put them out there for free for any other student union mm-hmm. Or student society to use. And we are amazed by the people who contact us to be able to use this. You know, we have people in Ontario that are pushing for this, other schools throughout British Columbia. And I think student societies have really begun to mobilize around this issue. And we're hopeful that the early action that's been taken at UBC will really push us in the right direction to be the leaders in OER adoption.
So where does the campaign stand now?
So the campaign's been going on for 3 years now in the AMS, and this is the year that we've actually seen the greatest, involvement from students. You know, when we had that first booth outside of the bookstore where people could come and they could just pin up the price that they paid for their textbooks, it was huge. It was so important for people to be able to see that, and we had professors come by and stop by and talk to us. And so the Textbook Broke campaign is really at a point that, of course, we're trying to have increased education, because what we have found is the more that students ask their professors, you know, can I use an older version of a textbook? Mm-hmm. Is this textbook required? There's actually been studies that the more those questions are asked by students, the more that professors question the resources that they use. And we're hopeful that the more that we can educate people about this, the more that, you know, faculty are going to take a second look, that departments are going to take a second look at the resources that they use. And the whole goal of this campaign is, you know, to really bring the impact outside of the people who are just kind of working on this issue. And we want it to really be something that's not only being pushed by the AMS and by student advocates, but also by students themselves. This is something that, you know, I think hopefully, you know, we can see in the next couple of years that everyone that comes to UBC uses an open educational resource at some point. And not only uses an open educational resource, but perhaps contributes to an open educational resource. And that's where we're trying to bring this campaign, is to really not only educate students, but to educate the entire campus about how important open resource adoption is and how dire the textbook situation is. People can't continue to spend upwards of $800 a year, sometimes $1,000 on textbooks. That's ridiculous. You know, people should be able to spend their money on better things. You know, we have a housing crisis right now. We have rising costs for tuition. And, you know, the one area that is the easiest to actually tackle, you know, UBC can't control off-campus housing prices. You know, we're in difficult budgetary standards for tuition, and that's something that's really handled by the province, if anything. So the one thing that we can do is textbooks, and that's something that we can really put forward and commit to student affordability.
Yeah, so one thing that you mentioned that I think is really kind of maybe integral to students who are listening to this, and how students could maybe like get on board with this campaign, is that they need to kind of communicate with their professors. And I think that there's often like a barrier between students and professors, and especially if you're in a really large classroom, it's you know, it's kind of an intimidating like process to actually talk to your professor. Maybe you don't really feel like there is, an opportunity to converse with them on like a one-on-one level. But yeah, like you mentioned, it's really important for students to be engaged with their professors. And I think a lot of professors, like, they want students to be engaged, but it's difficult when you have massive classroom sizes.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So I think that that's kind of part of what I think is really cool about this campaign, is breaking down kind of the divide between professors and students, and even like breaking down that kind of like power line, and what you mentioned about students actually being able to contribute to OERs is really awesome.
No, that's what's so amazing about this, is that not only to advocate for this campaign do we need to break down those barriers between students and faculty, but also to create these resources, because students are people that will be able to use these resources and give back feedback. You know, you don't really get to do that with a textbook. And this is something that not only can students give feedback, but they'll be able to contribute to it. This is something that we're hopeful can actually be, not only can you learn from the resource, but you can learn from helping to contribute to the resource as well, which is what's so great about OERs.
Yeah. So, I guess I was going to ask how kind of students can support this campaign. Mm-hmm. So I guess maybe talking to their professors about it could be one thing. But yeah, how can students kind of be involved in this?
Yeah, so there's a lot of ways that students can help. You know, talking to your professor is the very first way. You know, even if during that first class they tell you, you know, the textbook isn't optional, ask them again. You know, ask them in an email or something, say you weren't at the class or you missed it. Because the more that you get people to question those resources, the more that you get them to really think about the textbooks that they're using, the more that they're going to question, you know, why are so many students not buying this textbook? Why are they asking me that this, if this is required or not? And they're going to realize that, you know, this is expensive, that they need to look at their resources again. And another way that students can really help is the Academic Experience Survey, which we already talked about. That survey helps us with so many things that we do with advocacy at the university level, and not only the university level, but the provincial level too, and all different levels of the government. That survey has so many important things in there, and you know, if we can get more and more students to answer that survey, it only bolsters the results that we get from that. And it's something that the university seriously looks at every single year when we publish it. And unlike the university, you know, we publish all the results of our surveys. You know, we show everyone what happens from this survey. And it's something that not only informs us, but can help inform students to advocate on their own. And, you know, doing both of those two things, talking to your professors as well as engaging in, you know, student data-driven advocacy is so important.
Yeah. So, what was I going to ask? Something about students. There's stuff coming up in February, so this month, with the campaign. So do you want to kind of touch on that?
Yeah, so this, coming up either this February or sometime in March, we are going to be having advocacy boards all throughout campus. And so these boards are going to be educational. They're going to talk about some of the data that we've collected. And not only are they going to talk about that, but they're also going to show things like the heat map that we did with arts and science and looking at how expensive resources are in some departments compared to others, as well as it will be something that's not only educational for students, but for faculty as well, because a huge important part of this is that, you know, students knowing about this issue alone isn't going to help. I think, you know, isn't going to be the only thing that helps. Sorry.
Yeah.
It's important students know about this. But, you know, you need to be able to have faculty know about this. You need this to be something that's important to the university. And also, it needs to be something that's important to the government as well. And so having these advocacy boards around campus is really to try and educate everyone that comes to this campus on how important of an issue that this is.
Awesome. Where can students find more information about the survey and also the campaign?
So for the survey, I wish that I could memorize the link. But if you just go to the AMS Facebook page, it's on there, as well as if you just look at your emails, it's on your AMS newsletter, and we've sent it out. We've emailed it to students. And then to learn more about OERs, feel free to reach out to our office. We also have an OER page on our website. So people can learn all the different things that we've done for OER advocacy there, as well as people can talk to our campaigns and outreach commissioner, Christina Ilnitsky. She's actually the one who we really have to thank for a lot of this work. She created all the new materials for this year and really kind of put that forward. And, you know, she's really been the one that has been driving this campaign and has really been the one that's gotten all of this engagement. So we wouldn't have been able to do all of this without her.
Awesome. Shout out to Christina. Yeah. So, Max, thank you so much for joining us. And yeah, I'm really hoping that this campaign sees success. I mean, I guess it already is in some ways, but yeah.
We're super hopeful to see the success of this campaign. And we're hopeful that the university will take this issue seriously, because we know that students are and we know that faculty are. And so the only thing that we really need is for the university to step forward and really say this is an important issue.
Awesome. Yeah. So thank you so much for joining us, Max.
Yeah. Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
Hey, my name is Michael, and I am part of the team from the UBC Psychedelic Community. We recognize the ability of psychedelic substances to facilitate altered states of consciousness that can be beneficial for therapy and personal growth. Our aim is to promote an unbiased, fact-based discussion of these substances centered around their application to areas such as psychiatry and neuroscience, among others. As a club, we host socials where people can come together to discuss their own experiences. As well, we host speakers on campus to discuss a variety of topics related to all things psychedelic. Find us on Facebook at UBC Psychedelic Community for more information.
Do you want to help build a brighter future for Canadians? The UBC Young Liberals have a proud history of leading progressive change. From equal marriage rights to legalizing and regulating marijuana and so much more, we've helped shape Canada's future, and now you can too. We want you to share your ideas with Justin Trudeau and the Liberal team at the Liberal National Convention in Halifax from April 19 to 21. By signing up as a UBC delegate, you'll have access to lower fares and an experience to last a lifetime. Are you in? Register at 2018.liberal.ca.
Hi, we're Roused by Nature.
And you're listening to
CITR 101.9, broadcasting from Vancouver, British Columbia.
Sweetheart, I'm not one to play with foolish hearts, but you sat there so quiet, it was all that I could do. But talk until you looked me in the eyes. I came off a bit dry, you were all over my brain. It's all the same. They're ticking, stay, and oh, I'm wide awake and my torpor
Tune in to African Rhythms every Friday from 7:30 to 9 o'clock with your host, David Love Jones, as he plays a heavyweight selection of classics from the past, present, and future. This includes jazz, soul, hip-hop, Afro-Latin, funk, and eclectic Brazilian rhythms.
Lots of people, they take it like a game.
My name's Chris Horrific.
You always wanted his character to be bigger than life.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is without question the greatest sports and entertainment event of all time. Be a part of it Monday
from 1 to 3 p.m.
The Parts Unknown Show on 101.9 CITR. Sometimes cosmoses collide.
Break your fingers!
You are listening to UBC Happy Hour on CITR 101.9 FM, and you just heard Untangled by Gentle Mind, who is a local UBC band. And up next, we're going to be hearing an interview that I did with Grace McDonald, who is a law student at Thompson Rivers University. And she spoke at UBC about a month ago as part of Pride Week here at UBC about what it's like to, go to the Supreme Court to challenge Trinity Western Law School. This is my interview with her. So we are joined by Grace McDonald, who spoke at the Queer Law 101 event that was part of the Pride Week here at UBC. Hi, Grace.
Hi, Alex. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. So could you please briefly introduce yourself and your involvement with queer law in Canada?
For sure. So as you said, my name is Grace McDonald, and I'm currently a third-year law student at Thompson Rivers University in Kamloops, BC. I'm finishing up my law degree. I currently sit on the equity committee at our law school. I'm also an executive on the Women in Law Society, as well as being president of the Outlaws, which is our law school's LGBTQ advocacy group, which is kind of how I got my start in queer law. I'm also queer myself, so that kind of helps things. And I just kind of, these are personal issues that I take very seriously. I got interested through our club and eventually became president, which opened up a lot of doors into doing some really neat advocacy work with TRU law, as well as working with UBC and UVic law as well.
Awesome. You sound so accomplished. I love it. So you recently, as mentioned, you spoke at the Queer 101 Law event, which was part of Pride Week, which was hosted by the UBC Pride Collective. So maybe what is queer law? And maybe just if you could give us a quick overview of how queer law is part of the current state of law in Canada.
Right. So queer law has been around for quite some time, but more recently gained a lot of attention through a lot of high-profile cases, as well as a lot of great grassroots-based community activism, which I kind of have gotten involved with as well. But my presentation in terms of queer law in Canada was mostly focused on what has happened since gay marriage was legalized in 2005. It doesn't seem like 2005 was that long ago, but really there's been a lot that's happened recently. So I really focused on the most recent federal apology that the government made to LGBTQ individuals, and just more generally, queer law is essentially, in my perspective, achieving queer LGBTQ rights and just being treated as equal members of society, which some people may be surprised is actually still not the case in a lot of our communities, unfortunately. But I focused a lot on the federal apology that was given, the Trinity Western proposed law school case, Bill C-16 involving transgender rights. There was also recently a bill in Alberta which now makes it illegal to for a high school to call the parents of a child who have joined a gay-straight alliance, as well as there's currently kind of a war against sexual orientation and gender identity groups that are trying to educate LGBTQ individuals in high schools, and that's occurring at a Chilliwack school trustee member. And then there's also a few things I discussed, including the ban against gay men donating blood, and then hopefully, sometime soon, a ban against gay conversion therapy.
Wow. Yeah, that's a really long list of things you covered. Yeah, but I don't know. It's really interesting because I think that sometimes, like here in Canada, especially, I think those of us who live in cities, I don't know, we might be kind of like under this illusion that, oh, we're so, you know, accepting and, you know, everything's like kumbaya, but there's so much happening that there's so much work that still needs to be done, as you kind of highlighted. So, yeah, that's super interesting. And you mentioned the Trinity Western case, and yeah. I wanted to talk a bit about that because I think that that's especially relevant to kind of the student population. So, yeah, could you maybe kind of touch on that case, the Trinity Western Law School case, and your role in that case?
Right. So Trinity Western is a private evangelical Christian school, which has a proposed law school. And essentially the issues that my coalition group, as well as many individuals have, is that they force their students to sign a mandatory community covenant, which among other things, such as you state that you will not get an abortion, you will not drink alcohol or consume drugs. It states that you can have no intimacy between same-sex couples. So, and then there's a few other things saying that there's no intimacy in the common law relationship, that it must be between a man and a woman, and they must be married. And it also, there's a footnote in there that actually goes to a Bible passage which says that homosexuality is vile. So there's a few issues in terms of if any LGBTQ students would ever want to attend a law school where they have to sign this mandatory covenant. So that's basically what the case is about. It pits religious freedoms against equality rights and the right to be free from discrimination.
Right. And so so what was your role kind of in this case or fighting against the case?
Yeah, so UBC Law, UVic Law, and my school, TRU Law, we banded together to form a coalition of law students. And they weren't just LGBTQ individuals. This was allies as well. And our position was essentially that, you know, studying the law, it's not about necessarily an evangelical Christian perspective, and that you should be able to study the law in a space where you feel safe and you're able to fully be yourself. And so we're wholeheartedly against forcing students to sign a mandatory covenant. So we produced this. We have lawyers, and we produced this legal argument with the assistance of our lawyers. And the case kind of went all the way to the Supreme Court of Canada. So we actually got to travel to Ottawa to attend.
Wow. Was that like kind of a shining moment, or how did that feel being there?
It felt pretty incredible. There were some interesting things that happened leading up to it. The TRU Outlaws actually did a few phone calls with the federal government in terms of improving their relationship with LGBTQ individuals. So we actually got invited to attend the apology 2 days before the hearing in Ottawa. And that ended up with us meeting with the Prime Minister.
Whoa, okay. what was the outcome of the case?
So the case was heard on November 30th and December 1st, and the Supreme Court of Canada typically takes 4 to 6 months to write their judgment. So we're in the waiting period currently. So we won't get a judgment for a few more months.
Okay. Okay, wow. So is it kind of nerve-wracking, like waiting on that judgment?
It's nerve-wracking, but also just the advocacy work that we were able to do and the opportunity that we had to talk with so many individuals. And I know we're obviously hoping for one certain outcome, but just everything that's happened and the communications we've had and the friendships that we've built with other schools and even the government has just been, like, absolutely incredible. So it is nerve-wracking, but also it's been a time for us to reflect on how much of, a positive impact we've been able to have.
Yeah. So you mentioned earlier Bill C-16. So I'm wondering if this case kind of relates to Bill C-16 at all, and maybe kind of like the interplay between these different subjects that you were talking about.
Right. So in most queer law cases, we're looking at advancing LGBTQ rights. There definitely has a connection in terms of we're striking out the covenant. Hopefully, we're protecting LGBTQ rights. And in terms of B-16, which actually amends the Canadian Human Rights Act to give gender identity and gender expression, it adds to the list of protected grounds, which kind of seems like we would already have that in the code, but unfortunately we don't yet. So we see this as just continuing to protect LGBTQ rights.
Yeah. Awesome. And I'm wondering what kind of public reception you and your fellow legal activists got from this case, like with Trinity Western, because it was, it's all over the media. And I'm wondering, if was there positive reception, negative reception? I imagine maybe some of both.
Yeah, I think that I've done a lot of media interviews and I've faced a lot of internet trolls, unfortunately, and I tried as best I can to, ignore that, because for every, 10 negative comments or homophobic comments I receive on a weekly basis still, it just takes, honestly, one person to come up to me and just say, thank you so much for fighting for my kids' rights. I'm so tired being a mother and I'm unable to do so, but thank you so much for doing that. It recharges my batteries completely and I just kind of forget about all the noise. So there are those kind of negative comments and debates on it, but the general reaction that we've had is incredibly positive, and I love taking, any amount of time out of my day to talk to people, and it is so important, like you said, and that people think we're all kumbaya, but people come to me and say, sorry, this is a stupid question, or this is a really simple question I should know the answer to, and I never look at it that way. I think society is changing so much that you should feel safe about asking these questions because they're so incredibly important.
Yeah, that's a great point. And, questions lead to discussion and, learning, and I think that that's super important. And, yeah, having that open dialogue is so critical. Yeah, so I guess lastly, what advice would you give to other young activists based on your experiences?
I would say be persistent. It is, being an activist or being an advocate is a bit of a demanding job, and it's usually something you're doing for free, and it's a huge full-time job in its own right. So, but if it's something that you're passionate about, be persistent. Don't be afraid to put yourself out there, and rely on your community. There's a lot of people that you can look to or friendships that you can build. But also, through this, I've reached out to my member of parliament, Pamela Goldsmith-Jones, and she was wonderful in terms of support as well. But just, be determined, be passionate, and talk to as many people as possible. And like we were just saying, even if they disagree with you, just listen to them and try to understand the argument and the points that they're bringing to the table too, because that's the only way we're going to kind of get things done, is if everybody's listened to and everybody's has a seat at the table.
Amazing. Grace, thank you so much for joining us on the show today. And all the best with the rest of your work.
Great. Thank you so much for having me, Alex.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Amy.
And I'm Ada.
We're your co-chairs for Pharmacist Awareness Month here at UBC. Kicking off the first week of March, we'll be hosting a pill drop from the 5th to the 9th in the Nest every day from 12 to 2 p.m. Bring in your unwanted or expired medications so they can be properly disposed of.
We'll also be having booths on mental health, recreational drug use, and even a naloxone kit demonstration. Search us up on Pharmacist Awareness Month on Facebook to keep up to date with all our upcoming events.
We'll also be having competitions and giveaways in the Nest throughout March, so come check us out.
Hey, my name is Michael, and I am part of the team from the UBC Meditation Community. Our aim is to help students develop a meditation practice in order to promote well-being and overall health. Our club is open to any and everyone, as meditation is truly something that can benefit those from all walks of life. Membership is $5, which gives you access to our sits, which we host Monday through Friday. Find us on Facebook at UBC Meditation Community for more information.
Much better than when I'm doing nothing. If I doubt I'm so, think I.
So you just heard Prig by UBC band Gulo, and they were actually playing live on CITR last Friday as part of 24 Hours of Student Power, and Micah Burlow, who is in that band, is a really good friend of CITR because he's part of Blank Vinyl Project, which is a really cool music organization here on campus. And then you also heard a track from Haley Bleh called So Far Gone. And yeah, she's also a UBC student. So yeah, love to hear music from students. So this is UBC Happy Hour on CITR 101.9 FM. Thank you guys so much for listening, and I hope you guys are all having a great end of your reading break. And we will catch you next week when we are back live, and we're going to be hosting some debates between the AMS presidential candidates. So yeah, tune in live next week from 5 to 6 p.m. for UBC Happy Hour. Thank you so much, and have a great weekend.
Indie rock band Portland's Typhoon will be playing at the Rickshaw this Saturday, February 24th, on the strength of their 14-track epic new album, Offerings, that many critics are already calling an early contender for Album of the Year. Opening for Typhoon are the Wild Ones, also from Portland. For ticket information, head on over to www.rickshawtheater.com. Born out of an initiative to give more voice to local women artists and musicians, Mixtapes is a Vancouver-based biannual mixtape featuring women-identified musicians and sound artists from the Pacific Northwest. The Spring 2018 edition will be coming out on May 10th, with all proceeds going to the Downtown Eastside Women's Shelter. Women-identified artists are invited to send their submissions to btchtapes@gmail.com. The release fundraiser will be held on May 10th at the Redgate Review Stage, featuring artists selected for this edition of the cassette.
Hey, how you doing? This is Sean from Youth Brigade. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.